Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
In case you were not aware, we have already announced that you will be a permanent fixture for the Week in Blog, rotating with Matt Lewis. So we're all very excited.
Oh, excellent. And to those who aren't fans, sorry, you're stuck with me.
And me, I don't even get, no one even rotating with me, so you're really stuck with me. The number one priority of the Tea Party wish list, the repeal of Obamacare, has been achieved in the limited reality of the House floor. There's no expectation that it will even reach the Senate floor, let alone be signed by the president. So how are conservative bloggers dealing with the new reality of the health care reform law still on the books?
Well, first of all, they're very excited. You have a lot of folks who are blogging and sort of taking on the question of why does this matter? Understanding there's no way President Obama signs it. Why would we even put in the effort to do this? And Mo Lane at Red State puts it plainly, says that the reason why you do this is because it's the right thing to do. That and there's sort of this excitement that Republicans have. You know, didn't just talk about repeal in a campaign and then chicken out, that they're sort of doing the things that they said they would do, which is delightful to many conservative bloggers. And you also have a lot who are talking about, you know, not only does this send the right message, does it show voters that we are doing the things that we promised we'd do, and even though it's not going to get signed, you know, we're taking these actions anyways. They say the other thing is this will set up an interesting debate in the Senate. And you have, well, first of all, it has two things. One, it gives Republicans momentum. Jeffrey Anderson at Weekly Standard says this gives Republicans momentum in the days and weeks to come. They will work to defund Obamacare. They will conduct oversight hearings on such matters as the Obama administration's misuse of taxpayer money to promote Obamacare. And most of all, they will advance serious Republican alternatives to this unprecedented threat to government, limited government fiscal solvency and liberty. In that, that this does have symbolic purpose beyond just assuring constituents that we did what we said we'd do, in that it can give momentum to other efforts. And then you have Brian Darling over at The Foundry, it's Heritage's blog, who sort of lays out a way in which the bill can come up in the Senate, rather than Harry Reid just sort of being able to push it away, and lays out this very procedural, or lays out the procedures that would be required in order to bring it up for debate. That once the Senate receives the bill, any senator can use Rule 14 to object to a second reading of the bill, and that objecting to Rule 14 would hold the bill at the desk of the Senate, rather than letting it go off to a committee. It would put H.R. 2 on the Senate calendar. And then any senator can use Rule 22 to commence debate on H.R. 2 if they have held the bill at the desk. It's the filibuster rule. And so if any senator can gather 16 signatures on the cloture petition, they then file that with the clerk of the Senate. This commences a proceeding that would end a vote requiring the 60 to shut off debate, which basically would put the Senate in an interesting position because you have a lot of debate about filibuster reform. It would sort of force Democrats into a position of having to filibuster against this bill, puts them in a tight bind. And then it also, you know, Republicans in the House want to see folks in the Senate have to cast a vote on this again in this cycle, especially knowing, you know, there are a number of vulnerable Democrats coming up in 2012. They want to get that vote on record that these folks had the opportunity to vote for a repeal and didn't, sort of another mark on their record when they go to the ballot box. So that's primarily the sorts of things that I've been seeing. Has anything been discussed on the left about health care repeal?
Well, I mean, the left has generally been more dismissive of the Republicans' inability to agree upon a shared set of facts when it comes to the debate. You had Jonathan Bernstein at the New Republic going into considerable detail on why it matters that the Republicans just refused to accept the Congressional Budget Office numbers as they were, despite the fact that they'd previously lauded CBO to the skies when the early drafts of the health care bill were found to increase the deficit. All of a sudden, when it was found to reduce the deficit, the CBO was either a bunch of hacks or dupes, and basically ends by saying if they really believe that the CBO's numbers are somehow cooked and phony, it makes it a whole lot harder to reach a deal on healthcare and therefore the long-term budget. There's a danger of a closed information loop, and it makes compromise impossible, even if the interest representative of both sides would benefit from cutting a deal. If they can't, I mean, the whole point of having a nonpartisan, neutral accountant in the Congressional Budget Office was to say, okay, everybody, whatever your opinion is, these are the numbers, these are the best estimates we can get. Let's use that as our basis for our debate. And that seems to not be how Republicans began this whole discussion.
Well, I think the one thing that the conservative blogosphere has been lauding lately is this, you know, 4-minute YouTube clip of Congressman Paul Ryan, a personal favorite, going onto the House floor, and he gave this 3-minute speech that goes in detail through all of the reasons why he believes the CBO numbers had sort of cooked the books. And in his statement, is very clear that he doesn't think that CBO itself is intentionally going out of their way to cook the books, but rather is saying that Democrats presented a bill, he uses the phrase, full of smoke and mirrors. And then he goes through in this 3 minutes and shows, you know, this is $70 billion that's being double counted. This is this provision that's being double counted. This is this tax that's being double counted, and discusses all the reasons why he thinks that it's a problem. And he says that the big issue is when you ask the CBO to discuss its impact on the deficit versus the debt, you get two different answers. Because when the CBO looks at a piece of legislation in terms of how it impacts the deficit, they just look at that one piece of legislation in isolation. But when you talk about the debt, apparently CBO does their scoring in a more comprehensive way that takes into account a variety of other factors about how that piece of legislation would interplay with other things. And how that impacts the overall picture, which is why Ryan's remarks say, all these people who are talking about the deficit, that's not the complete picture. Let's look at what CBO says about the debt. And then there's the other statement that he's used a bunch of times that seems like fairly common sense math to me, which is that the bill has 10 years worth of tax increases, but only a smaller portion of expenditures. And so, of course, looking over a 10-year time horizon, when you're bringing in money for more years than you're spending out, it's easy to make it look like it's less expensive than it is over a timeline when you are both bringing out and spending for the same amount of time. So that's why he's sort of been a hero in the conservative blogosphere this week, because he got to go on the floor. And there's also one of the bloggers that I had mentioned before had said this is it, and this was Mo Lane at Red State, had said this is why it's important for us to have the majority, because if we didn't have the majority, Paul Ryan couldn't go on the House floor for 3 minutes and say these things, but because he's now chair of the Budget Committee, he has that platform from which to make his case. So that's, as best as I can paraphrasing Paul Ryan's remarks, that's been the statement that has generated a lot of excitement.
Now, I would note that the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities has debunked everything that Paul Ryan has said on this subject. There is no double counting. The whole 10-year tax window thing is bogus because the CBO said the second 10 years is even bigger as far as your cost savings are concerned, your first 10 years. So if the 10 years was smoke and mirrors, you'd fall off a cliff in the second 10. That's not the case. It somewhat gets me back to, or gives me an opportunity to talk about Paul Wallman's blog post in TAP, the American Prospect blog, which basically makes an argument that, to quote him, as a group, Republicans don't really care much about health care. That's why there is and has long been a wonk gap on the issue. Republicans will gear up to fight against the Democratic reform effort, but when that's not going on, it just isn't high on their list of priorities. So he was making the point that the whole notion of repeal and replace is all going to sputter out when you get to the replace part, because they just don't really care all that much. It's not on the top of the list of things to do. But it also seems to get at, it's not even necessarily worth it to even get the numbers right here, because if you're not going to take the next step and actually craft a workable policy, it's a lot easier just to throw out pot shots.
Well, from a political perspective, there's a grain of truth in the sense that Republicans do need to come up with something workable as an alternative. That repeal on its own is not enough, because there are components of the bill that alone poll very well, are very popular, Things like pre-existing conditions, letting kids stay on their parents' health care until they're 26, stuff like that. You know, it actually sets it up for Democrats to say, hey, Republicans just tried to repeal protections for folks with pre-existing conditions. So that's I would agree that it is critical for Republicans politically that they need to come up with something, and that I'm interested to see what will emerge, because I have not yet seen a whole lot bouncing around about what it would look like besides a package of trying to keep in place some of the more popular things, as well as introducing stuff like purchasing across state lines, other things that Republicans had sort of talked about during the debate the first time around.
I mean, is it possible that at the end of the day, it's not important for Republicans to come up with this alternative plan, and that as much as the conservative bloggers there is excited about the notion of forcing a Senate vote and finding ways to keep talking about it, that they might just say, we had our repeal vote and maybe we should talk about something else right now.
Well, and I would agree with that wholeheartedly, in that this has sort of been something that myself and my other colleagues at my firm have been big believers in, is that Republicans need to talk about the economy. That while every moment we spend talking about healthcare may be very satisfying to the folks who healthcare was their big issue and they wanted to see that repeal, but now that's done, and so the biggest focus, before we even talk about an alternative, needs to be getting the economy back on track. And to the extent that Congress has any ability to do that or to pass legislation that is pertinent to the economy. And that'll have a lot to do with spending, too. Folks see a big connection between government spending a lot and economic growth. And so I think that the economy and jobs needs to be the absolute focus for congressional Republicans moving forward. And to the extent that that means that they put less emphasis on finding an alternative, I think it means they should put less emphasis on finding an alternative. The economy is just still the overriding issue, period.
Now, there is this a different order of topics than we were going to do, but since you mentioned what Republicans are going to do on spending, there still is a big question of what will they actually articulate as far as specific spending cuts are concerned, and how will they try to push that around the upcoming vote to raise the debt ceiling, which has to be done periodically for the federal government to meet its outstanding debt obligations, and they'll hit the next wall sometime in the spring. I talked about this with Con Carroll last week about how some Republicans have already acknowledging that, oh, yes, we know we can't actually default. We can't, at the end of the day, it's going to have to get raised. But before then, let's see what kind of concessions we can extract. What's the latest chatter in the conservative blogosphere about how the Republicans should play this?
So the latest chatter is either there are three sorts of things. First, you have Jennifer Rubin at Washington Post, who says her post is entitled "Do GOP Debt Limit Schemes Make Sense?" And first of all, the post sort of goes into the fact that this is a little premature, that we have a couple of months to think this through. It's not as though we're about to default tomorrow, although June's not terribly far away, and that Republicans are also, they're not going to just cut a third of government spending right now. I mean, that's the amount of money that would have to be cut in order to not have to, I mean, it's not possible. And you've seen folks like Pat Toomey who are coming out and saying that they understand that this is very difficult and we're going to probably have to raise this debt ceiling, or if not, we would just have to massively cut government spending in one fell swoop. There's a post on Ricochet by Peter Robinson entitled "The Bogus Threat of Default," where he goes through the different points about why the threat of default, and it's, oh my gosh, it's coming right now, Republicans, you have to raise the debt ceiling or America's going to, you know, sink into the ocean, is a little bit overblown, and says Pat Toomey means business. He's not about to permit himself or his fellow Republicans to be panicked by a bogus threat of default. And the quote from Senator Toomey is that next year about 6.5% of all projected federal government expenditures will go to interest on our debt, and tax revenue is projected to cover about 67% of all government expenditures. So with roughly 10 times percent more income than needed to honor our debt obligations, why would we default? That the problem comes when you have to cut a bunch of spending. Now, when you were talking about spending cuts before, I made this very excited face, and then because actually, I get asked this question frequently, like, what would Republicans cut? And I'm always like, I'm not in Congress. I don't know what they want to cut. you know, there are two strategies. You can either keep all your programs and just reduce the funding to all of them and say, hey, you got to do same amount, but you got to do it with less, or you just cut entire programs. And so there is a post by Ed Morrissey at Hot Air about GOP set to roll out $2.5 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years, and it has actual programs and things that will be cut. Some of them I like, some of them make me a little nervous. Some of the cuts include cutting the $150 million subsidy for the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. It would cut...
What have they done lately?
They apparently somebody is having trouble getting to work on time, does not like the Metro. It would cut in half to $7.5 billion, the federal travel budget. I mean, you hear reports a lot of times about, oh, this federal government agency booked X number of first-class tickets that were unauthorized, and they booked this number of duplicate tickets and this number that weren't made. So the thought being, cut the travel budget, people will have to do more with less. Suddenly you can't just accidentally book duplicate first-class tickets anywhere because you don't have that much money to work with. Other things include cutting $445 million annual subsidy for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, sorry, PBS, and $1.5 billion in annual subsidies for Amtrak. But then this post also goes on to say that this is sort of just superficial, that alone is not going to save the federal government, and that...
I mean, that's all nickel and dime stuff.
Yeah, it's only a start. The quote is, it's really only an appetizer, and it says the main drivers of deficit spending are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other mandatory spending on entitlements. Even if Democrats agreed to these cuts, Congress would still have to raise the debt ceiling by a significant amount to allow the Treasury to sell bonds to fill the gap. But in a response to all the questions of what are Republicans going to cut, there are now some concrete answers. They may not be as satisfying.
But these haven't been embraced by Speaker Boehner yet.
No, I do not believe these have been like endorsed by the broad Republican consensus or leadership. But these are just—it's a proposal that's out there. Mm-hmm. It's Jordan's Spending Reduction Act, and it also includes the bulk of cuts come out of it's returning non-defense discretionary spending, and it's returning spending to a level at 2006 spending levels rather than it's been talked about. We'll go back to 08 levels, and going back to 06 is a little more dramatic a cut because Democrats were not in control of Congress yet. Anyhow, that's currently the discussion about where things would be cut. But with an acknowledgement that it's got to come from entitlements. And I think you had mentioned that there's sort of interesting debate around entitlements on the left as well. But go ahead.
Oh, yes. Well, certainly there's a great anxiety on the left in regards to what the president will say in the State of the Union address on Tuesday, specifically in terms of Social Security, because there's been speculation at least that the White House is considering an embrace of parts of the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction plan, which also includes cuts to Social Security benefits, which I should point out, even Simpson and Bowles say in their paper, not necessarily what they say on TV, but in their paper, that Social Security is a separate issue from the deficit. It's not it's literally a separate issue. It's not part of the rest of the budget. It does not contribute a penny to the deficit, which we all know and love. There's a question about the Social Security's solvency on its own, but it's not a deficit issue. Nevertheless, Simpson-Bowles, when they make public statements, they often conflate the subject. Sometimes Obama has conflated the subject. Sometimes he has not. But he has always said that something should be done to shore up Social Security's long-term solvency. And most people on the left agree with that to the extent it would be something very mild and would not cut people's benefits. People are very comfortable on the left with raising the payroll tax cap, for example. But as far as raising the retirement age, which is an effective benefit cut, although it would be for younger workers, or a change in the cost of living formula, which would affect current retirees as a structure of the Simpson-Bowles plan, those things raise far more hackles, and folks on the left have been arguing in the blogosphere and elsewhere, particularly my own organization, Campaign for America's Future, that it would be not just bad policy-wise, but politically devastating. You had Paul Rosenberg at Open Left saying, "Will Obama stab the Democratic Party in the back at the State of the Union?" Citing a poll that my group did with the Democracy Corps showing how unpopular this is, regardless of party affiliation, whether you're a Democrat or an independent or a Republican, There's opposition to raising the retirement age or cutting benefits otherwise across the board. So the argument is saying, look, you're going to split the Democratic Party. You're going to upset rank and file voters, whether independents or they're even Tea Party conservatives. You have Dan Frumkin at the Huffington Post with a similar piece saying, oh, Obama's Social Security talk is turning voters off, pollsters say. That post-election poll by Celinda Lake's Lake Research Partners found by a margin of 3 percentage points, Americans now trust Republicans more than Democrats when it comes to Social Security, the first time since the program became a signature issue for Democrats in the 1930s. And the argument is because there's been more uncertainty about what Obama's going to do in Social Security and has not been resolute in defending it as of late. Progressive Blue, Michael Conrad, talked about the end of the Democratic Party as we know it if Obama took this step. So is that kind of tenor of discussion in the liberal blogosphere? And so the question becomes, I think, for the White House, can you dismiss that as just, you know, typical carping from certain corners of the left, like with the tax cut deal, but once you did it, it was widely supported across ideological stripes, or is this a bigger issue? Because you have all this polling data showing that support for Social Security is very broad. Is the blogosphere going to successfully make the argument to the White House? You know, even if, you know, your new economic team headed by Gene Sperling has, you know, a wonkish desire to do this, it is so politically devastating that you would be absolutely crazy to do it. And no one knows. The Hill reported just this week that even though congressional leaders on the Democratic side don't want the president to do this, that they have not told them what they're going to do. So it's true unknown what is going to be said. That's why my group has a petition now basically saying, here, now is your chance to tell the White House, don't do this, have the impact before the speech. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if the conservative blogosphere is picking up on this debate at all, or they're just shrugging their shoulders before Obama says anything. They can't believe Obama would ever do anything to cut Social Security. They want to cut Social Security themselves, so they hope it should be done. I don't know what they're saying.
No, I mean, anything. I honestly haven't read very much. Most of what I'm reading about reforming entitlements is this week is mostly tied up in the healthcare debate rather than on Social Security. There's a really interesting piece by Philip Klein who posted over at the American Spectator about the sort of money quote at the end. I mean, it's mostly about the healthcare bill and the CBO report and the things that we just spoke of. But then he goes into this sort of interesting connection between the healthcare bill and entitlement reform and things like that, and says even if one were to grant that being the Democrats' assumptions about the expenses. The Democrats are still left with an unorthodox path to fiscal responsibility, one that drastically increases America's entitlement obligations at a time when the nation is in the early stages of a long-term debt crisis caused by an inability to pay for the entitlements that we already have. The problem is that the combination of things like Medicare cuts and tax increases that are used to pay for Obamacare are now no longer mm-hmm. available to offset the ballooning costs of these existing entitlements. That basically, you know, the things that Republicans don't like as far as tax increases or the things that are making Obamacare appear deficit neutral or deficit positive in CBO scoring, you could have used those tools to address something else. So even though you've created a program and now you're paying for it in another way, you know, I think the idea is, well, if we're going to be taking that money, why don't we apply it to the problems we've already got? But that's sort of the only thing that I've seen on the right, and that's Medicare. That's not even Social Security, really. My question for you is, do you think that there'd be any sort of compromise position that Obama could take? Like, say, we're gonna move the retirement year for folks who are really, really young, and as a compromise, we will remove the cap on the payroll tax cap so that, you know, you don't stop paying Social Security tax once you've made a certain amount. Do you think that there is a position place for a compromise, or do you think this is like hold firm, absolutely no cuts?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, Simpson-Bowles does all that. They do raise the payroll tax cap and they cut benefits for current retirees with the cost of living adjustment and they raise the retirement age.
But so it's that package, that package is unacceptable? Okay.
I mean, it's certainly unacceptable to the progressive movement as it stands almost across the board. And the polling that we've done would indicate that would be rejected by a broader segment of the public too. So I don't think that is a basis for a compromise. Now, if the president tries to do a piece of that, if we try to just the payroll tax cap hike, the left would be perfectly fine with that. If he did not a cut on current retirees, but he raised the retirement age, which would affect non-current retirees, would affect younger workers, that might be certainly the left would still oppose it for sure. That we have evidence in the polling that the broader public would oppose it too. I think the debate would be very different, though. You know, people might oppose the retirement, you know, the retirement age hike on the presumption that's going to affect them. You know, if the president could argue, well, it's not going to affect you, it's going to affect the other guy, the guy who's, you know, 26 years old, then maybe a portion of folks would be okay with it. But then, of course, you're hitting a segment of the population which have been long-term Obama supporters. So they would say, hey, wait a second, why are you cutting my Social Security benefits? Or they might say, hey, I never thought I was going to get Social Security benefits anyway. Now I'm going to get them, so I'm okay with it. I think that debate might get more complicated.
Well, I think the point that you just made about young folks not thinking they're going to get Social Security is absolutely right. That's there was polling done. I think it was done by Zogby, but it was of young voters, and it asked them, "Do you think that you will receive Social Security benefits? Do you think you'll receive Medicare benefits? And then, do you think your children will receive Social Security and Medicare benefits?" And the numbers are horrific. I mean, young folks they don't think it's going to be there. They've sort of accepted that it's gone. I mean, I even sort of chuckle. You get these statements every year from the Social Security Administration, like, here's how much you've paid in, that, you know, you'll one day maybe get back as benefits. And I just sort of I'm not confident that's going to happen, you know? So
well, I mean, just as a matter of, you know, facts in the Social Security Trustees report, no one in the Social Security Trustees has ever said that the program will literally go bankrupt and that any worker, you know, 10, 20, 50, 75 years from now will literally get no benefits. I mean,
right.
The biggest threat is that if you literally did nothing at all, that in 2037, the Social Security payout, instead of it being 100% of your expected benefits, you'd get 75%. Essentially, you'd get a benefit cut.
Right.
So that's the big fear, is that there'll be some kind of benefit cut. So the debate that the Simpson Bowles folks are having was, hey, do our benefit cut instead of the benefit cut that will happen if we do nothing. But no one is arguing that it will literally implode and nothing will be there. Although I grant you, there's a perception out there.
Yeah, it's not totally rational, but I just look at it as, like, I'm not planning on getting that money. Let's put it that way.
So if some of that polling was truly accurate, and someone who was 26 really thought, hey, I'm not getting anything, and now I'm being told I am going to get something, even though the facts are you're going to get less than what you would have gotten.
Yeah.
But your perception might feel like you're getting more than what you thought you were going to get.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen any polling about how young voters would react to these specific proposals, but the initial premise that young folks are not confident that they will receive benefits, that is true.
Right. So I
both think, anecdotally and in data that I've seen.
Right. So I think it would depend on, you know, what exactly Obama proposed, how he presented it, how he sold it. If it's anything that amounted to any sort of benefit cut, the left, in almost near unity, will oppose him vociferously. It wouldn't just be a little, you know, annoyance. It would be a big, full-throated opposition. And he'd have to, if it was to get done, it would have to be done, you know, have to overcome that obstacle.
Do you foresee this becoming? Would the left be united, or would this, for instance, on the Republican side, we had immigration in during the Bush second term that really, you know, ticked off the right, and they became extraordinarily vocal, you know, for good reason about portions of the legislation, and it went to die. Would this sort of be Obama's version of that if he went that direction? I mean, the right was fairly unified against Bush on that. There were, you know, some folks in the middle of the McCain camp initially, but that was a pretty unified right against the Bush plan.
Yes, I think it would be a similar reaction, and I think it would be a high priority reaction. It wouldn't just be like, "Hey, I'm mad about him about this." It would be a central organizing point against him, what would potentially cause a very serious rift. in his coalition.
Gotcha. Well, next week as I watch the speech, if he says he's going to cut benefits, I will be thinking of you.
But there's also, I think, a broader question beyond the Social Security piece of it is, and this gets back to what you're talking about with Republicans and spending cuts, what is Obama going to say about deficit reduction, period? And to what extent is he specific? To what extent is he going to say, here are my numbers, show me your numbers? Is he going to force, is this going to be a central fight that he has with Republicans on how do you do deficit reduction? And is he going to have a lot of the left at his side when he does that, because if he takes a lot of conservative ideas or center-right ideas in pursuit of that, he won't have the left by his side. But there are progressive paths to deficit reduction that have been proposed, and he could embrace those and have the left as his wingman. I mean, presumably he'll do things that will draw from left, center, and right, because that's his general want. But how you mix and match that would certainly change how the progressive blogosphere would react to it, how liberal activists in Washington would react to it, how moderate independents would react to it, how conservatives would react to it. So I think that's just a huge wild card that no one really knows. You know, it used to go into George Bush State of the Union, so with a pretty good idea what he was going to say. I was never wildly thrown by what came out of his mouth at a State of the Union address. With this one, I have no idea what's going to be said. And I think it could very much define what the contours of debate are going to be for this year and the 2012 campaign.
Are there any bloggers that have any specific expectations, or is that just sort of a general sense out there that this is a real wild card?
You know, I mean, there's certainly a portion of the progressive blogosphere which is more, you know, pessimistic about this sort of thing and are going into it assuming that Obama wants to do Social Security cuts and drastic deficit reduction. And there's, I mean, still largely organizing to try to prevent that from happening, but are taking it as the presumption that he wants to do these things. And I don't personally share that. I'm coming from a place of ignorance. I don't know what he wants to do. But certainly, if I can segue a little bit, you know, there was this article that came out in the New York Times Magazine, a preview in the New York Times Magazine, from Peter Baker about Obama's economic team, going over what went wrong over the past 2 years and what they might do going forward. And you had a lot of I told you so type commentary on the left about it. Felix Salmon, who blogs for Reuters, saw it as proof that, you know, Larry Summers was primarily at fault for not allowing the stimulus to be big enough, because he told Christina Romer, one of the other economic advisors, to not include a $1 trillion number as your high end for a potential stimulus package. Felix Salmon said Larry Summers, who should have cared much more about unemployment than he did and was in large part responsible for the incoherence, the most important arm of the Obama administration, going beyond the point about that stimulus number, but that just that he ran a very dysfunctional shop and was not a good manager of staff. Marcy Wheeler, who blogs at Fire Dog Lake, the Empty Wheel section of that site, scoffing that foreclosure and housing in Hamp didn't even come up in this giant New York Times Magazine article, which you seem, I think, jointly blame both the reporter and the White House itself for not even getting into that in great detail. Mike Konzel, who blogs at Rorty Bomb, also shared that critique. And there's a critique there. This is sort of the fundamental weakness in the Obama economic strategy, that they've not solved the foreclosure crisis, that foreclosures continue, that the banks have not been cracked down upon, and that's what's holding the economy back. So because there is a critique out there in the liberal blogosphere that Obama has a bad economic team, that feeds a notion of presuming that a bad thing is going to happen, I think, in the State of the Union address. And even with, you know, Obama's statement this week that he was going to do a review of regulations that are on the books to try to weed out the ones that were ineffective. You know, in that executive order, he states very clearly that he thinks some regulations are good and that he doesn't shy away from what new healthcare regulations he has enacted and what new Wall Street regulations he has enacted. You know, it's a much more of a nuanced executive order. you know, it's nothing akin to Bill Clinton in 1995 saying, I made a mistake and I shouldn't have raised taxes so much. You know, Obama's not apologizing for anything there. But because he is taking a nuanced view of it, a lot of bloggers look at that and say, oh, you're giving into conservatives again. You're buying into conservative frames and glossing over the parts that defend regulations and focus on the parts that acknowledge, hey, some regulations, you know, regulations in themselves aren't magical. You know, there are good ones and there are bad ones. So they're not inclined to give Obama a lot of space and give him the benefit of the doubt. So it's going to come down to what Obama actually says and to what degree they think Obama has not taken too much of the conservative side of the argument.
Does frustration from the left about Obama's economic team, does it at all relate, or is this a factor at all, that, you know, some folks like Ortzag wind up going right back into the financial sector in very high-level positions after they've left? Like, is there any sort of skepticism that there's too much coziness between his team and...
Oh, it's a huge issue in that portion of the progressive blogosphere. Although I was personally struck in the New York Times Magazine piece that said Ortzag left because he was the most obsessed with deficit reduction. And more people on the team said, yes, the deficit is important, but not now, not in the middle of a terribly weak economy. And that Ortzag left because he was losing that policy argument. So, you know, here's a portion, I mean, you know, this is all very complicated, and I don't think anything, you know, cuts very clean as far as who's right and who's wrong. But that piece of the article, which I thought was very interesting, I did not see a lot of pickup in the blogosphere because that would suggest that Obama was not going to do anything particularly draconian on the deficit and risk the economic recovery in the short run, which is the argument that most of these liberal bloggers and myself included have. So that's a positive sign. Now, you know, signs are one thing. What he says is another. Let's see what he says in the State of the Union address. But no, I didn't see a lot of bloggers clinging to that line in the article and saying, oh, it's all going to be okay.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they're focusing on the parts of the article that says, boy, they really screwed up by listening too much to Larry Summers.
Mm-hmm. There's not a lot on the right about this. There is a piece by Pete Wehner in Commentary, just a post from today, or post from yesterday, rather, where he says... But at some point, it may dawn on Mr. Obama that the problem is not simply his team, but the economic ideas and philosophy that are guiding his decisions. Those appear to be harder for him to replace than Larry Summers. So there's not a lot of concern about the individuals so much as he's got the wrong economic philosophy. We still disagree with him. And so it goes. I will say that I enjoyed Larry Summers quite a bit, his character, rather, in The Social Network. So.
Which I have not seen. So don't give away the Larry Summers ending.
I won't. I won't tell you what happens.
But I think a lot of folks on the left have that same general view. I mean, they're mad about the policies more so than the people. I do think a lot of blogging gets hung up on the people. Mm-hmm. And so no one's you know, spiking the ball because Larry Summers and Rahm Emanuel are gone because they don't like Bill Daley and Gene Sperling too much either. They think it's going to be same old, same old. But there's other arguments that are made in the blogosphere saying, look, it's, you know, Obama's the guy at the top and these are his policies. And, you know, the right's criticizing these policies because they think they're too, you know, big government and tyrannical socialism. And the left doesn't like them because they think they're too close to Wall Street. So as long, you know, if Obama came out with a, not that I expect this is going to happen, but, you know, just a total progressive wish list in the State of the Union address, they're not going to care that Bill Daley is chief of staff anymore. You know, they're people are mad about Bill Daley because they're concerned it's going to lead to policies that are not cracking down hard enough on banks, are not solving the foreclosure crisis fast enough, or not pumping enough money into more infrastructure investment. You know, that's the stuff that they're concerned about.
Okay. That makes sense.
Is there anything to say about the slow-moving Republican presidential primary effort?
It is very slow-moving. It is very, very slow-moving, and I'm I heard that Obama's going to be again his campaign in, I think, March or April is when that's going to fire up. But I have no idea what's going to happen on this Republican side, except the big sort of talk in the blogosphere this week. There have been a few things. Tim Pawlenty's book came out. So the big quote that I've seen tweeted a lot today is he makes a quote about Mike Huckabee where he says something like, because he talks about his faith a little bit in the book, and he says, but I'm not here to out-preach Mike Huckabee, something like that. So kind of interesting. It seems to me that Pawlenty's taking a lot of pages in one sense out of the Romney playbook from last time, in that, you know, Romney, here he was, this governor, just leaving office, needed to build his sort of name ID, convince conservatives he's one of them. It seems like Pawlenty's running almost the same playbook this time, really trying to be active and out there and, you know, little things going on all the time. Meanwhile, Romney's taking a very different page, or writing a different play this time, being sort of very quiet. Popping up when he needs to, but sitting it out when it's unproductive. Someone who is not sitting it out, even when it may be unproductive, is Sarah Palin. And this has been the other interesting thing that I've seen in the blogosphere this week, is you've traditionally had, I mean, you have lots of schools of thought on Sarah Palin, but you, if I were to overly simplify it, you have the folks who think she's formidable, she's not to be underestimated, and even if right now she doesn't have support among independents, she's got an appeal, and she can really definitely win a primary, and she's going to be our girl. And there's another school of thought that says, no way, she's got enough problems with independent voters, not going to happen. She's not a serious candidate. And usually that that second camp has been sort of the David Frums of the world, occasionally the Ross Douthats, who are sort of like, she's not serious. She's hurt herself too badly. I think this week you're starting to see, in light of her response to the shootings in Tucson, put directly in contrast with Obama's wonderful speech, you've seen a lot of folks begin to sour on her prospects, who are still Sarah Palin fans, but are now sort of, you know, the writing is on the wall, so to speak. A big example of that is Scott Johnson over at Powerline, who had a post. There's a debate this week about he basically made a post saying Palin for president, it's not going to happen. That this is just too badly damaged her, and it's not going to work out. There was a reader named Michael Perry who wrote in with sort of defense of Palin and saying that, you know, ultimately that she still does have a fighting chance. Just because she's been, you know, there's been a lot of slander out there about her, she can still rise above it. But they, you know, this Powerline responded by saying, look, no one on this website has failed to respond aggressively to unfair attacks on Sarah Palin by the left. On the contrary, they have defended her as vigorously as any commentator and will continue to do so, is the quote. And they say, but this is beside the point. The purpose of a political party is to win elections. And they say they would be delighted if next month new polls come out indicating independents have suddenly changed their mind about Sarah Palin and that she's a viable candidate, but that isn't going to happen. She's been exposed to the American public, if not overexposed. Pretty much everyone has an opinion, and so I have to think the verdict is in and Palin is not a plausible presidential candidate, that the big outcome of her video has not been positive, and that while she may continue to garner the sympathy of conservatives who say you're being attacked unfairly too much for these things, there's also a concession that it has become an almost insurmountable task for her to pull it off in a general. And that's, I'm sure to folks on the left, they're thinking, please let the right nominate her. Please, please, please. We'd love that fight. But now you're seeing some conservatives.
But there are lots of Republican choices we say that about. So it's not, Palin's not the only one we're angling for.
You know, nobody's perfect. We will see who emerges out of this and who decides to run. The other thing, if we're going blogosphere 2012 gossip, Mike Pence's name keeps popping up I've seen that pop a lot this week in terms of people saying that they really, really like him, although I've also been...
It's not a Herman Cain boomlet out there?
Oh, there is a Herman Cain boomlet, to be sure. We'll see how far that goes. I'm interested to... I will be frank. I don't know enough about him to give you a full description of the Herman Cain phenomenon, except that I know it exists, that I've read about him,
pizza?
That he's an African-American businessman who's run for office before, that he is beloved by the crew over Red State in particular. That's where I read about him a lot. So we'll
but
see.
But have you had his pizza?
I have not had his pizza. I don't think so.
So I would think that would be the test. You know, if would he make America as good as his pizza?
Oh, if only the standard we were being judged by, this would be a fascinating election.
But to go back to Palin for a second, not that I want to obsess about it too much, but I'm it strikes me as a little odd that a lot of conservative bloggers are showing a degree of pragmatism. Hey, we know she can't win. Let's not, you know, go down. Let's not do Christine O'Donnell all over again on the presidential level. But is there any kind of then additional introspection? Is there anyone saying, why is it that Sarah Palin isn't embraced by independents? Is there something that does not work at the presidential level that we should not be encouraging others to replicate?
I have not seen so much of that introspection. I mean, much of it, as in the post that I just read to you, is that she has been in part tarnished unfairly by attacks on her that have gone way too far, that have been beyond basic criticism, and that have really just sort of sullied her name. And so that's not really replicable as much. I mean, that's sort of Sarah Palin specific. I don't even think it's ideological. I don't think people are saying she's too conservative to be electable. I think it's a personality issue, and that some are saying is her own fault. Some are saying is driven by an unfair climate around her. Some are saying it's a bit of both. But I don't think that that's something that folks see as transferable onto other candidates, or that other candidates are likely to make similar mistakes if they're new.
So does all that Palin support just shift directly into Michelle Bachmann, or is everyone, you know,
the Bachmann boom? Are you predicting it now? No, I don't know. I mean, and look, I think that people who like Sarah Palin are still going to vote for Sarah Palin.
If she runs.
I mean, the other post that Jennifer Rubin had today at the Washington Post was that she doesn't think it's very likely at all that Mike Huckabee or Sarah Palin will run, considering they have these multi-million-dollar media empires that they're sitting on. Why would you run for president? Running for president makes you a crazy person. I think there's a quote from John Adams where he says, the only person that would ever congratulate someone on becoming president is someone who has never been president. I've botched the quote, but it's something to that effect that,
He was never the nation's foremost optimist.
No. So, the post from Jennifer Rubin basically says, you know, if you're Sarah Palin, why do you even run for president? You know, keep making money. Keep being Sarah Palin, but as soon as you run for president, that like deflates all of the air out of the bubble, because then it becomes real.
I mean, it seemed to me like when she made the video statement, like that was an act of a presidential candidate, not an act of a Fox News pundit. You know, she could have just gone on to Fox News and said her piece and defended herself without having to do a videotaped, you know, professionally telepromptered statement with the American flag in the background. That was a choice that a politician makes. So I assumed at that moment that she was planning to run, but now I'm thinking that all of this conservative commentary, I mean, this might be an example, I mean, you never could definitively prove it, but if you have so many blog posts out there from prominent conservative bloggers saying, you're toast, don't do this, I mean, how could that not factor into your decision-making and saying, you know, why should I... You know, I still have a good gig going, as you say, with your multi-million-dollar empire. Why should I jeopardize it by showing the emperor has no clothes by running in a Republican primary and getting slaughtered?
Yeah, I have no answer to what is going through her mind or Mike Huckabee's mind as far as their decision process, but I can understand many arguments why one would not want to run for president. And in fact, Mike Huckabee's chief advisor, this gentleman named Chip Saltzman, very controversial, or has had some controversial issues in the past, but he's no longer working for Huckabee. He's now become a chief of staff on Capitol Hill very recently, sort of a signal that Huckabee is not going to run. So it looks like that line of reasoning is working out for Huckabee, that he probably isn't jumping in the race, to the extent that that also applies to Sarah Palin. We'll have to see.
So is there any conservative blogosphere interest if there's a critique that, you know, Palin's personality for whatever reason is not sellable at the national level, is there people saying, you know what, maybe we should give this Tim Pawlenty a look, we should give Mitch Daniels a look, we should give Mitt Romney a look. You know, they're not flashy, they're more sort of, you know, CEO bean counter types, but maybe that's what we need in a presidential candidate.
Yeah, I mean, then that would If the complaint were that she was too out there and vocal as compared to a Mitch Daniels, then you'd also see this criticism being applied to someone like a Newt Gingrich, who's definitely out there and speaks his mind and is very visible.
I imagine there's some conservatives that would say, I really don't think Newt Gingrich can
go
all the way.
Well, yes, there is that concern, although Newt Gingrich sort of has his own set of things he'll have to overcome. But I think that the appeal... When folks are looking at someone like a Mitch Daniels and saying he's got appeal, it's mostly about the policy rather than, yes, we've boring guy. Let's go. I mean, you'll hear folks like there was an AI panel that I was on with Ross Douthat where he said, you know, or he and Dave Weigel were both saying, you know, I think this is going to be the year of the bean counter guy as a contrast to Obama, because Obama was the celebrity in 08. And so if Americans don't think that went very well, maybe the natural reaction would be not to pick a Sarah Palin or another big celebrity, but rather to pick someone who is incredibly boring, vanilla, and can somehow be credibly trusted to get the country back on track. So I think that's something that I've heard before, but I don't think that people are looking at a Mitch Daniels and saying, yes, boring guy. They're looking at him and saying, this guy managed to have a budget surplus in Indiana during a recession. This guy has the policy smarts to get it done. He's real good on fiscal policy. Let's go. I think that's most of why you'll see folks having a sort of political crush on a Mitch Daniels.
But certainly in the conservative blogosphere, there's no coalescing around anyone yet.
No. And that has a lot to, I mean, nobody's announced yet. And as soon as those dominoes start falling, you may begin to see folks coalescing. But besides Herman Cain, I have not seen much coalescing around any one particular candidate.
All right. Well, let's leave it on that note. Always good to talk to you, Kristen.
Good talking to you, too.
And I guess we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. I'll probably talk to Matt next week, barring a unforeseen scheduling hiccup, which does happen sometimes. But until then, that's this week, and we'll see you next week for This Week in Blog.